have a smartphone in your pocket? How often do you go out for dinner and you're with your partner or best friend, but you're really not with them? How many times have you felt a phantom phone buzz in your pocket? What's that about? Taking regular breaks from his smartphone was quite a novel and scary idea for Devon, but he did it. And when I saw him the following week, he told me he felt different. A fortnight later, he reported he was sleeping better. We started to reduce his use even further, so he waited for 1 hour after waking to begin and stopped 2 hours before bedtime. After about 6 weeks, I asked him to begin changing his diet, replacing simple sugars such as cookies, cakes, and sugary cereals with healthy, natural fats such as eggs, avocados, and nuts, which are needed for hormone production. At the next consultation, he smiled and told me his mood and emotions were much more stable and he was getting anxious less and less often. 6 months later, I received a letter from his mum saying that Devon was like a different boy, with friends at school and no more problems, and that I had changed his life. I never did write him that prescription for Prozac. Can I say that reducing smartphone use alone was what made Devon better? No, I can't. This wasn't an academic study, and these weren't laboratory conditions. But I would go as far as saying that reducing his exposure at specific times of the day, combined with the dietary changes, turned his life around. This was a young man whose problems very easily could have been given a label, depression, and treated with medication. And that is happening over and over again in doctors' offices everywhere. Can you go without? The goal of this intervention is for you to examine, change, and then reset your relationship with your electronic devices. Clearly, it is not my place to tell you how to consume your digital media. That is up to you. My hope is for you to question your current usage. How much of it is what you have chosen, and how much of it chose you? Just because smartphones have email functionality, does that mean you have to use it? What happens if you don't? Many of you, I am sure, will be a little fearful of missing out on something important by not constantly checking your emails. But as a friend of mine recently realized, if your email says you are unavailable, you are unavailable. He realized that by turning them off when he was away, he was controlling his time and stress levels far better, rather than being controlled by his device and by emails from other people. That is, other people's agendas. It's really about trying to use your devices in a way that helps you rather than enslaves you. For me, one of the hallmarks of the addict is denial. They'll tell themselves, "Of course I could give up if I really wanted to, I'm completely in control." But then when it comes to the crunch, there's always some convenient excuse. "Oh, I would, but I can't today because blah." So if you find yourself thinking that smartphone dependency is not a problem in your life, why not try doing without a smartphone? See if you can manage it, just for 1 day per week. Will you find an excuse? I created a 7-day digital detox to help you work up to your screen-free Sabbath. The goal is to wind down gradually so that by the time Sunday comes, you will be ready to take the plunge and have an entirely screen-free day. If an entire day is too daunting, start off with half a day. You will still experience positive benefits. If your cell phone is your only means of communication, why not try having 1 day per week where you switch off its mobile data and Wi-Fi connectivity? You will still be contactable by text and phone, yet there will be less temptation to mindlessly surf the internet. 7-day digital detox. Monday, switch off push notifications on your phone, tablet, and laptop. Tuesday, unsubscribe from redundant email lists. Wednesday, set your email apps to refresh manually. Take emails, or at least work emails, off your phone. Thursday, device box for mealtimes. They must go in before you sit down. Friday, can you switch off all your e-devices 90 minutes before bed? Consider disabling your smartphone email inbox until Monday morning. Saturday, have 2 1-hour periods during the day where you are e-device free. See if you can enjoy some special moments without posting them on social media. Sunday, screen-free day. Live your entire day offline and without screens. 3. Keep a gratitude journal. Every night, before you go to sleep, write a list of all the things that have gone well for you that day and all the things you're grateful for. I discovered this simple but amazingly effective intervention from Charles Poliquin, a brilliant strength coach who's trained Olympic medalists in over 20 different sports. Back when I was a resident, I'd read his blogs and think about how useful some of the content would be for many of my patients. I wondered why we hadn't been taught any of these ideas in medical school. I was thrilled to meet him not long ago, and to learn that he has three questions he always asks his daughter before bed. What have you done today to make someone else happy? What has somebody else done today to make you happy? What have you learned? Now, the Chatterjee family does it too, except we do it around the dinner table. Even Mum and Dad have to take part. Once you've done it, it's really hard not to feel good. If you've had a bad day, it redirects your thoughts. We have a human tendency to focus on the negatives, but the questions challenge us to think, yeah, it was pretty good actually, or I learned XYZ today. And more often than not, we leave the dinner table glowing. What follows is a simplified version of this. Keep a pad and pen by the bed, and just spend some time before you go to sleep listing all the things that have gone well for you that day, and all the things you're grateful for. I found this to be really effective at redirecting your thought patterns in the crucial minutes before going to sleep, so that the weight of the world shifts somewhat. This may sound rather touchy-feely, but it's actually based on sound science. The esteemed U.S. psychologist, Martin Seligman, who is one of the founders of happiness studies, or positive psychology, had tested a version of this that he calls the Three Blessings exercise. It involves spending 10 minutes before bed writing down three things that went well, no matter how large or small, and also, in order to force you to further reflect on and immerse yourself in the good event, the reason why that thing went well. For Seligman, the act of writing it down is crucial. In a series of well-designed studies, he found that people who do this for a week see rises in their feelings of life satisfaction and a lowering of depression levels. According to Seligman, if you start making this a regular practice, you'll be less depressed, happier, and addicted to this exercise 6 months from now. Another U.S. study, led by Chad Burton of Southern Methodist University, had people writing about a positive experience for 20 minutes on three consecutive days. When they were tested 3 months later, the researchers found the participants enjoyed enhanced mood, less illness, and made fewer visits to their doctor. Remember, this was a full quarter of a year after their 3 days of journaling. A truly remarkable result. And researchers from the University of Manchester found that people who had more feelings of gratitude not only slept better, but also had more energy and increased focus. Of course, religious people have been wise to this clever hack for many centuries. Christians are taught to pray at the end of the day and give thanks. Much of what makes up religious laws are the learned life lessons in how to live well or maintain some sort of order within populations of people. In the pre-refrigeration age, it would have made sense not to eat pork if you lived in a hot country. These excellent rules for better living became codified as commandments from God. While I'm a Hindu by birth, I'm not pro or anti any particular religion. I fully accept and embrace the fact that tied up in each of them is a huge amount of common sense that has been passed from generation to generation. It seems to me that Christians probably found a dose of gratitude at the end of every day increased the quality of their sleep and their state of mind, and that this had plenty of genuinely positive effects on their health and mental well-being. It's only now, in the 21st century, that the modern scientific research is proving they were right. A simple tip is to buy a really nice journal or diary and keep it by your bed. Own it, love it, treasure it. For some of my patients, simply buying a little book that they love the look of helps them engage in the process. Whatever you write in it, the important thing is to note down three things every day that you're grateful for. It doesn't need to be complicated. Instead of focusing on the colleague who ignored you in the morning, why not focus on the one who brought you a coffee? Instead of focusing on the hard week you have had, why not think about the fact that it's now the weekend? It could be the three questions that I learned from Charles Poliquin, or it can be as simple as the fact you enjoyed your evening meal or you're happy to have a roof over your head. Writing these thoughts down helps subtly shift your focus. And in our modern world, where we are bombarded with images of perfection, it is easy for our thoughts to spiral quickly into negativity. 4. Practice stillness daily. Make time to practice stillness for at least 5 minutes daily. I've been a father for over 7 years, and it's only been in the last few months that my kids have started sleeping through the night. For such a long time, I struggled to cope with the exhaustion that comes with parenting. My energy level suffered. I'd find it hard to be as attentive as I ought to have been, and, sometimes, I'd find myself snapping at those closest to me. A few years ago, when my son was about 3, I tried something new. I'd come downstairs at 5:30 a.m. and meditate for 10 minutes. Sometimes I felt, what was the point of that? All I was doing was going through my to-do list for the upcoming day in my head. But on other days, I hit the zone a little more. Slowly, I found my energy levels getting better. I wasn't as reactive. I wasn't responding to things in the instant. I didn't get so cross in the car. My sleep improved. I was able to focus more on my work. Even though, during some sessions, I couldn't switch my mind off at all and was sure the meditation had been a complete waste of time, it didn't seem to matter. The effect remained. Meditation. Meditation is an umbrella term that can cover many things. There are purists who think it has to be done in a traditional way, sitting cross-legged and chanting a mantra. But I think there are many routes leading to the same result. I asked one patient who insisted she couldn't meditate to spend 10 minutes every day listening to her favorite song with her eyes closed without any distractions. I want you to hear the drumbeat. I want you to hear the vocal. I want you to turn the lights off and just be present, I told her. That, for me, is a musical meditation. Or is it a musical mindfulness? A term we've been hearing a lot of over the last few years. Well, maybe. Although meditation and mindfulness are not quite the same things, there's a huge amount of overlap. My definition of mindfulness is being attentive and present to what you're doing in the moment. For our purposes, though, I'd like to both broaden these terms and simplify them. Really, it's about stillness. Looking at it once again in evolutionary terms, when we were hunter-gatherers, we would have been used to long periods of boredom or mental stillness. Walking to the hunt, waiting for the fire to be hot enough, sitting around at night when there was nothing productive that could be done. Our daily lives would probably have consisted of lengthy episodes of calmness, punctuated by peak moments of stress. This is what our brains and bodies have evolved to expect. But the modern environment just doesn't allow for it. We spend most of our time simply overwhelmed by calls for our attention. This is just one of the ways in which our ordinary daily lives have become poisoned. And of course, there are numerous costs. The gray matter in our brains increases when we have regular periods of mindfulness, while meditation stimulates neuronal activity, aids sleep quality, aids concentration, and lowers blood pressure. More and more research is suggesting that stress can change the composition of the bugs that live in our gut, as well as their relationship with each other. We call these bugs, and all the genetic material contained within them, our microbiome. We're going to be diving deep into the incredible and powerful realm of the microbiome in the Eat pillar. But these trillions of bacteria interact with each other, and with us, and have huge impacts on our health. Their makeup and diversity influence everything from our gut function to our mood. Research on mice suggests that stress changes their microbiome. While we're not mice, it is very reasonable to think that this would be the case in humans too. In this way alone, lowering our stress by practicing stillness can have far-reaching effects on the rest of our wellness. These are the kinds of natural benefits we should be getting automatically, but that we've lost. We're born to thrive. We're born mindful. But with modern life and its myriad modern distractions, we are unlearning this innate ability. We are de-skilling. We're losing the power and wonder of our naturally mindful minds. One simple way to access this kind of mood state is with simple breathing exercises. We usually breathe unconsciously, but if we take the trouble to direct our conscious focus toward our breathing, it can have profound effects. When your out-breath is longer than your in-breath, you activate the parasympathetic nervous system, which you can think of as your relaxation mode. The opposite of this is our sympathetic nervous system, which is our fight or flight mode. Many of us spend too much time in fight or flight mode and not enough in relaxation mode. 3-4-5 breathing. I've come up with a simple exercise called 3-4-5 breathing. It couldn't be easier. Just breathe in for 3 seconds, hold it for 4, and then breathe out for 5. It's easy to remember and even easier to do. I remember one patient, 48-year-old Brian, who worked in a stressful job in a bank. Every lunch break, he would furiously puff away on cigarettes for 20 minutes to try and relieve his stress. He felt anxious returning to work after lunch, and this would last all the way through the evening, well after finishing work. This had deleterious effects on his sleep. I suggested that he try 3-4-5 breathing every lunchtime. This was quite an alien concept to Brian, but he agreed to give it a go. He only did it for a few minutes in his car every lunchtime, but the benefits were immediate. At my next consultation, he reported reduced stress, reduced anxiety, better focus throughout the afternoon, and, incredibly, better sleep at night. All from consciously changing his breathing at lunchtime. Having felt the benefits, those few minutes became longer and longer, and now he does 15 minutes every day. Brian started small and built up big. You can too. The important thing is just the start. Even 2 minutes per day will have benefits. Not got 2 minutes? Really? Do you manage to brush your teeth morning and night? I suspect you do. Why? Because it has been prioritized since childhood, and that priority has now become a routine. Perhaps it is time to create a new routine. 2 minutes of conscious breathing per day. Try to do this at the same time every day. It is much more likely to become a habit if you do. One of the main problems I find when talking about these ideas to patients is that people assume they can't do it. I've yet to find a patient for whom this is actually true once they found the right form of stillness practice for them. Another problem is giving up too soon. Patients often say, "Doctor, I tried it twice, I just couldn't do it." But I ask them, if I asked you to run the London Marathon, would you try to run 26 miles 2 or 3 times and then say, "I can't do it"? Or would you build up gradually? Most people understand that, to complete a marathon, you have to train your body to do it. In the same way, you have to train your mind to get used to practicing stillness. If you prefer to sit cross-legged on a special stool chanting Om, or staring into a candle, that's fine. But there is no right or wrong way to do it. There are a million ways to meditate, and one of them will suit you. You can meditate while walking, if you're present as you're doing it. Try focusing on your walking next time you're out. Focus on your feet hitting the ground. Be aware of the trees swaying in the breeze. Be mindful and pay attention. It is a completely different experience from walking while texting, sending emails, and checking your social media feed. Just breathe in for 3 seconds, hold for 4, and then breathe out for 5. Tai Chi is a form of moving meditation. You could do what Brian did and practice 3-4-5 breathing during your lunch break. You could do what I did and download an app that gives guided meditation. I recommend Calm or Headspace. What I like about apps is they help me feel like I'm doing something. You plug in your headphones and you press play. I am doing something now. Then you follow the spoken instructions. My wife, on the other hand, can't stand them. She is able to switch off, so finds it irritating to have a voice talking to her while she is meditating. And that's fine. Just do whatever works for you. You don't even have to use the same method every time. Mix it up. There really are no rules. Pick something you like and start doing it, even for a few minutes every day. You can do it wherever you want. In bed first thing in the morning, or even last thing at night before you go to sleep. In the car at lunchtime. How about mindful cooking, where you are completely lost in what you are doing? Another common obstacle to success is self-judgment. If you find it hard, don't judge yourself. I tried Tai Chi for the first time as part of a BBC documentary series I was filming and found it impossibly difficult. The instructor, known as the sensei, kept telling me to relax, but I just couldn't seem to get my head around it. Most of us haven't been mindful in years, so we shouldn't immediately expect to feel like the Dalai Lama. Don't be harsh on yourself. If your thoughts are racing, let them race. That's okay. Just make sure that you're observing them as they do it. That's still one step better than yesterday, when you didn't know your thoughts were racing, and you were just being carried along in the relentless stampede. Many of our natural capacities for stillness are lost as we grow into adults, and all the pressures and responsibilities of real life kick in. That's why it can be instructive to look at kids. They don't multitask. They focus on what they're doing. When I watch my son playing, he sometimes can't even hear what I'm saying. He's so focused on his latest Lego creation. If my daughter is painting a picture, I may as well be invisible. She is completely immersed in the process. It's the same as when Tiger Woods was playing well and dominating the golf world. Someone like that, fully involved in the match, doesn't hear the crowds. He doesn't even see the crowds. He's in the zone. In a very real way, he's practicing mindfulness. He's utterly present, there, in the moment. This is sometimes known to psychologists as flow state. Stillness interventions you might think of trying. To get a check mark in this section requires dedicated daily introspective practice, and so my top recommendations would be meditation, guided or unguided, or deep breathing. Meditation with an app like Calm. Deep breathing. Yoga breathing practices such as breathing in through the left nostril for 4, holding for 4, and breathing out through the right. 3-4-5 breathing. 5 minutes of coloring. Sitting in silence with full awareness of your senses. For example, feel your feet on the floor, the breeze on your cheeks, etc. Listening to music mindfully. Headphones on, eyes closed, fully focused. Achieving flow. Flow does not need to be the preserve of high-performing athletes or Buddhist monks. We can all experience our own flow state, but we need to find out what it is that puts us into it, because it's different for everyone. We also need to be strict about scheduling time for it and making sure we're not disturbed, otherwise we'll never get there. I'm as prone as anyone to the distractions of the modern world. Even while writing this book, I found myself constantly distracted by text messages, phone calls, mindless surfing, and quick peeks at Facebook. I only managed to complete it by switching off my phone. It can be helpful to use apps. I recommend Freedom and Antisocial, which are available at freedom.to and antisocial.8opct.com to block the internet. But I've also experienced flow state on many occasions. I'm a keen musician and have spent a lot of my life writing and performing. When I'm working on a new song, I can become utterly lost in my own creative process. When cutting tracks at the studio, it's not uncommon for 8 hours to pass like 8 minutes. Why? Because I'm in flow. Time passes in a different way because I have complete immersion in what I'm doing. This is a form of stillness. The stresses and distractions of ordinary life are blocked, and the mind is in a peak state of focus. The growing awareness that many of us are losing this skill has led to the popularity of adult coloring books. It's remarkable how still your mind has to be to engage with coloring, and perhaps this will be the first entry point for you. If you're more familiar with yoga, you might have heard of the sequence called Surya Namaskar, or Sun Salutation. This is a series of postures that incorporate controlled movements and breathing. 5 minutes of focused sun salutations, if done mindfully, can be fantastically restorative and help you fully rejuvenate. There are many different options for your 5-minute practice of stillness. The more you practice, the easier you'll find it becomes. Even better, as your 5-minute daily practice becomes ingrained as a new habit, you'll find this will help you to be more mindful when engaging in your 15 minutes of me time at the top of this pillar. If you're not lucky enough to be able to completely immerse yourself in your favorite pastime for 5 minutes or more every day, then practice stillness wherever you can. In the car, in a coffee shop. You can even do it in the fitting room of a clothes shop. If you have the smartphone app and some headphones, you can do it more or less anywhere. On many occasions, I have done mine on the train. A great tip is to do it at the same time every day. That way, it becomes a habit. And if you consciously change your habits, you unconsciously change your biology. These are the little daily decisions that work on your body in the same way as medicine. If there was a drug that could do what regular stillness practice can do, it would be worth billions. It really is that powerful. Ideally, you should aim to build up to 10 or 15 minutes per day. But you don't need to stop there. Begin slowly if you need to. Even 2 minutes is a good start. It can be intimidating if you have never done it before, and we cannot expect that, after years of having an overactive monkey mind, we will immediately be able to switch it off. When was the last time you were fully immersed in something you loved? What gives you that flow? Is it gardening, reading, cooking, painting, tinkering with engines? Whatever it is, seize it. Own it, guard it, practice it. Use it as your way of gaining stillness. 5. Reclaim your dining table. Eat one meal a day at the table, in company if possible, without your devices. When I was a child, Mum would always take the time to make us home-cooked meals. My parents were raised in Kolkata, and this was just part of the lifestyle there. Pretty much everyone in India cooked from scratch. But growing up in the 1980s, in the north of England, I had no idea how lucky I was. Mum would prepare piles and piles of sizzling, fragrant, delicious food, and there would always be containers of it stacked in the fridge in perfect portion-sized Tupperware boxes. If I was ever hungry, I could just raid the fridge, dish some food out onto a plate, and warm it up in the microwave. My favorite was chicken curry with rice. I remember pacing impatiently up and down, waiting for the microwave to ping, before perching myself on a chair at the breakfast bar to blow on forkfuls of rich, sweet, spicy curry and shoveling it, still scorching hot, into my mouth. It was heaven. But as I got older, and there was more exam pressure from school, this slowly but surely developed into a bad habit. And not just for me. My brother and I would come home from school and our plates would get warmed up one at a time in a microwave. Then we'd each carry our meals with burning fingertips to be eaten separately on the sofa in front of neighbors. I can see why my folks thought they were doing us a favor. If we caught up on our favorite Australian soaps while we were eating, that left more time later on for homework. And they were right. We did gain valuable study time, but we lost something else. Something that I believe today is perhaps even more important. What we lost was that feeling of us all sitting around together, gossiping, laughing, bickering, and doing all the things a family should be doing when they get together. What we lost was connection. Firelight talk. All those hundreds of thousands of years ago, when the design of our bodies was still being developed by the slow forces of evolution, I suspect we never went off to eat by ourselves like this. And it isn't just common sense that tells me so. It's actually possible to get a decent idea of what life was like when we existed in hunter-gatherer tribes, because there are still many in existence, in parts of the world that have had little contact with modernity. One of these tribes, the Juhansi Bushmen, lives in Namibia. Researchers who study their behavior report fascinating switches at different times of the day. During daylight hours, their conversation is mostly devoted to practical outcomes, such as possible hunting strategies and the mediation of arguments. But when the sun goes down, all that changes. Around the campfire, more than 81% of their conversation time is spent telling each other stories. The researchers call this firelight talk. It's a time of calmness, reflection, and, perhaps most importantly, connection. It's only in the last few years that the importance of social connection to physical health has started to become clear. Because we've evolved as tribal creatures, living happily in large groups, the brain interprets social isolation as a major problem. Once again, in this situation, the body thinks it's under attack and puts itself in a kind of emergency mode. Levels of the stress hormone cortisol tend to be higher in lonely people. There's also evidence it triggers our fight-or-flight stress response, causing chronic inflammation to increase. One major meta-analysis from 2012 that collected data from over 100,000 people found the effects of feeling socially unconnected were comparable to smoking and roughly 3 times more damaging to health than being obese. Another study that followed the effects of loneliness over time found that feeling isolated in 2002 was predictive of who'd be dead just 6 years later. Loneliness expert Professor John Cacioppo compares the state to pain, hunger, and thirst. You'd not want to be in these states, at least not for very long, he says. But each has evolved as an aversive biological signal that motivates us to do something that's good for us. Physical pain motivates us to take care of our physical body. Loneliness motivates us to take care of our social body. Reclaiming your dining table. This is why I recommend eating at a table. I know that the Juhansi aren't doing this, but the point of this intervention is not the furniture, it's the togetherness. In the modern West, the table, rather than the campfire, is where our connection, or our firelight talk, happens. And that's not the only benefit it brings. Sitting helps take us out of fight-or-flight mode and puts us into relaxation mode by activating the parasympathetic nervous system. You digest food properly when you're in relaxation mode. When you're in fight-or-flight, you don't. Eating at the table also means we're likely to consume less. Recent research from academics at the University of Birmingham has found that when we eat in front of the television, not only do we consume more at that particular meal, we also take in more calories later in the day. Why is this? It might surprise you to learn that hunger isn't the only thing that affects how much you eat. Memory also plays a part. If we're absorbed with watching a cheetah chasing an antelope on the latest David Attenborough documentary, while mindlessly shoveling food into our mouths, we'll probably remember less of our meal and may start getting "I'm hungry" signals sooner. Attention also plays a role, and for similar reasons. After around 20 minutes of eating, the brain starts sending its "I'm full" signals. These signals are partly dependent on how much we've already eaten, information that comes not only from the sheer volume of food we've swallowed, but also how much of it we've seen, smelled, and tasted. Even as recently as 20 years ago, it was common for families to eat their evening meals together. Nearly every house, even smaller ones, had a space reserved for doing exactly that. Nowadays, some homes don't even contain a dining table. Communal eating has been a basic part of the human condition for hundreds of thousands of years, and yet over the last few decades it's almost completely vanished from many households. Our dining rooms have been knocked through, often to make even bigger spaces in which to watch TV. But this doesn't have to continue. The good news is that it's an easy problem to fix. There are many different options to suit all budgets, including foldaway tables if space is limited. Recently, Jenny and Paul, a couple I see at my practice, started to make a point of eating together at my suggestion. Jenny, who is 51, has always struggled with her weight and suffers from mood swings. Her husband Paul, who is 52, meanwhile, doesn't sleep well and has a daily 2-hour commute to and from work. He's constantly tired and is starting to lay down fat around his middle. Just 5 years ago, this guy was in tip-top shape. After just 1 week of sitting and eating together, and moving from a processed diet to a whole food diet, they told me they felt like completely different people. Now they're talking more, they're finding out about each other's day, they're more mindful about what and how much they're eating. Of course, I don't know whether it's the eating together or the better diet that's having the greater effect. And in truth, it doesn't really matter. The point is, it's about the threshold. These two interventions have moved them in the right direction, back toward the right side of their personal thresholds. They're eating better, they're eating less, and they're feeling closer. These changes alone are having profoundly positive effects. Eat. Perhaps because we live in a culture that's obsessed with appearance, we've become dangerously caught up in thinking that diet is merely about weight. It's forced us to focus relentlessly on fats and carbs. Many of us, especially those over the age of 30, have grown up being told that we should eat a low-fat diet. It's only recently become clear that such advice was at least partly misguided, and it's led to some unfortunate and unintended consequences. In practice, cutting out the fat often meant ramping up the sugar and refined and heavily processed carbohydrates, with all too predictable results. We also forgot that fat, as long as it's the right kind, can be good for you. But this doesn't mean we should make the same mistake again by going too far and deciding that it's all about eating a high-fat diet. There's always a tendency to overcorrect and oversimplify. It's tempting to believe that there is, somewhere out there, the perfect diet, and all we need to do to achieve perfect health is find it. Many people, of course, believe they've already done so. Low-fat, high-fat, high-protein, low-carb, vegetarian, vegan, the list goes on. And it's true that each of these options will be effective for some people, but none is a one-size-fits-all solution. A huge problem with today's food culture is the sheer amount of conflicting advice that's flying around. Contrary to what you might think, I don't necessarily have a problem with any of it. If being a vegan or sticking to your own interpretation of paleo is working for you, that's fantastic. But I simply refuse to believe there's one true diet that's optimal for everyone. Remember, humans have always been opportunistic omnivores. All through history, our diets have been dictated by geography and climate. We ate whatever food was available. This means the evolved human machine is capable of thriving on a whole range of diets. Blue Zone Diets. Around the world, there are some apparently almost magical enclaves where the proportion of people who live past 100 is up to 10 times higher than the average rate. They are nearly always in good health, with much lower rates of chronic degenerative diseases, such as dementia, as well as heart attacks and strokes. These places have been coined Blue Zones by the Belgian scientist Michel Poulain. As you might imagine, Blue Zones have been widely studied by nutritional scientists, hoping to discover the one true diet. And what do you think they found? That the secret of Blue Zones was low carb? Vegetarian? Gluten-free? Not a bit of it. What they actually found was an enormous variety of diets. Some were eating meat, some, like the Seventh-day Adventists in California, were vegetarians. Some were eating more fish, while others, like the Okinawans, were feasting on high-carb foods like sweet potatoes. What is the right diet for you? One drawback to giving generalized food advice is that the correct diet for any individual really depends on their state of health. Someone who has been abusing their body for 20 years will have to make more dietary changes to get to the same place as someone who's in relatively good shape. The optimal diet for you is likely to evolve and change as you grow older. A child will usually have different health priorities from those of an octogenarian, just as a bodybuilder will, compared to an expectant mother. Having said all that, there do appear to be some very broad and basic principles that are consistent among all the Blue Zone diets. None has a processed food culture. By and large, they eat fresh, unprocessed local produce. They all sit down and eat meals together. They eat what's in season. They have treats, but only at very special festival times, such as Christmas and Easter, not every day after school or every Friday or Saturday. It is these principles that I intend to focus on. Making a change. There are 5 suggested interventions for this pillar. Each one will help you improve your health. And the good news is that they all connect with each other. So when you start doing one, the other 4 become considerably easier. They are applicable to everyone, no matter what your dietary preference, meat-eater, pescatarian, vegetarian, or vegan. They are designed to be sustainable and achievable, and you should take them at your own pace. For those of you who want more direction, I would suggest starting with denormalized sugar and daily microfasts. These can rapidly improve the way you feel and make it significantly easier to achieve the other interventions. A special word on gluten and dairy. Although not a specific part of this book's plan, I'd like to share with you an intervention that I have seen change many patients' lives: elimination diets. These diets are hotly debated and are surrounded by a lot of confusion and emotion. Here's my perspective. Going gluten-free. Humans have evolved eating whatever was available, typically meat, fish, eggs, vegetables, fruit, nuts, seeds, and legumes. It appears that grains, such as wheat and barley, are relatively new introductions, but that doesn't mean we haven't evolved to eat them. Unlike some experts, I'm not completely anti-grain. But when I want to treat a patient with a specific problem, such as joint pain, headaches, or eczema, I'll often ask them to avoid gluten-containing grains for a 4-week period. This means cutting out things like bread, pasta, and cereals. Many people react to these foods without realizing it, and removing them from one's diet can reduce inflammation. Cutting out dairy. It's the same with dairy. Some people appear to tolerate dairy just fine and may derive health benefits from consuming it, but for many it causes adverse effects. At least 75% of the world's population are thought to be intolerant to lactose, a sugar present in milk and cheese. Yogurt tends to have much lower amounts. Even if you're not lactose intolerant, a significant number of people have a sensitivity to different components of dairy, such as the protein casein. Many patients I see have spent their lives entirely unaware that they're unable to process dairy properly and are amazed when symptoms they've lived with for years suddenly clear up. A recent patient of mine had spent years suffering from severe heartburn and a long-standing dry cough. Despite multiple medications, dozens of specialist appointments, and 4 invasive endoscopic investigations, his daily life was unbearable. After 3 weeks on an elimination diet, his problems cleared up entirely. He tried reintroducing the eliminated foods, and his symptoms returned. He didn't need me to convince him. He was sold. He remains symptom-free to this day. I've seen complaints such as recurrent sinus or tonsil infections, skin conditions such as eczema, migraines, IBS, and heartburn, mucus production, and problematic mood changes disappear when patients eliminate these foods. That said, I never recommend the gluten-free products found on retailers' shelves, many of which are highly processed and full of sugar. I recommend instead whole foods which naturally do not contain gluten, such as meat, fish, fruit, vegetables, rice, and buckwheat. There's a false perception that giving up gluten is necessary only for sufferers of celiac disease. A plethora of studies have shown this not to be the case. Misguided commentators in the media have portrayed the avoidance of gluten and dairy as some sort of dietary fad, as if they are somehow essential food groups. They are not. There are several populations around the world who consume little to no dairy, such as the Chinese, and do just fine. Medical practitioners tend to require hard evidence that a certain food is causing an issue before asking a patient to try cutting it out. The problem with that approach is that such proof is often hard to get, with even blood tests being notoriously unreliable. I'm not convinced we should demand such rigor before giving it a go. A well-managed elimination diet is both free and harmless, while potentially resulting in a vast improvement to your health. It can be helpful to get professional advice to help structure your own elimination diet to ensure you are consuming your full spectrum of nutrients. 1. Denormalize sugar. Retrain your taste buds by removing all sugars from your cupboards and get into the habit of always reading the label on your food to check the sugar content. This has been one of the hardest chapters for me to write. Why? Because sugar is absolutely everywhere these days and hides where you least expect it. All of my patients consume wildly different amounts of sugar, but what is consistent amongst pretty much all of them is that they are consuming too much, at least with respect to their health. My goal with this particular intervention is to help you reset your relationship with sugar. The best way to do this is to dramatically reduce your consumption. But to do that, you first need to know where the sugar is. We have outsourced our food choices to massive global corporations. They're deciding what goes into their products and, therefore, what goes on in our bodies. In this way, decisions made in faraway corporate boardrooms are causing cascades of biological changes to happen inside us, changes that could cause pain, stress, infirmity, and even shorten our lives. This might sound melodramatic, but it is, nevertheless, unarguably true. Take sugar. If you're eating processed or pre-packed food, there's a very good chance that your intake of the sticky white stuff is through the roof. The only way to get any real idea about the amount you're consuming is to get into the habit of looking at labels. I'm still mesmerized by how many seemingly healthy packaged foods have sugar as a prominent ingredient. If you go into a branch of a popular supermarket, you can pick up packs of sliced roast chicken breast from the refrigerated section that contains sugar. Why does meat need sugar in it? Please tell me I'm asking because I genuinely don't know. These retailers are playing fast and loose with our health simply to gain the very tiniest imagined advantage over their rivals. Sugar is finding its way into more and more of our foodstuffs, and it's we who end up paying not only at the tills but also with our health. Type 2 diabetes is now at genuine crisis levels in the UK. Since 1996, the number of Britons diagnosed with the condition has more than doubled, from 1.4 million to nearly 3.5 million. On top of that, there's an estimated further 1.1 million currently living with it undiagnosed. An extraordinary 10% of the NHS's entire budget is spent treating it annually. That's $37.2 million every single day. More than $1.4 million an hour. Even the food we give our children is spiked with sugar. The recommended daily intake limit for children is 5 teaspoons, and the average British child consumes 3 teaspoons at breakfast alone. One of the most troubling trends I've seen over my 17 years of practice as a doctor is an increasing number of children who refuse to eat fruit or vegetables at all. On an evolutionary level, when has this ever happened? It's truly bizarre, but it's a measure of the extent to which the food industry has hijacked our bodies. We should feel outraged by this. A peach used to be a delicious summer treat, but if your taste buds have grown used to Haribo, something as beautiful and wonderful as a perfectly ripe peach rapidly loses its magic. We are allowing these corporations to blunt our own built-in, proper taste perceptions. Changing your taste buds. A part of the problem is that overconsumption of sugar seems to alter our taste buds. As they become used to it, our bodies crave more and more. One illuminating 2016 study compared two groups of people who initially were consuming the same amount of sugar. One group was put on a low-sugar diet, while the other group continued on their existing one. The group consuming a low-sugar diet rated the same dessert as sweeter than the group who had not reduced their sugar intake. As every month passed, they rated it as more and more sweet. This is further evidence that reducing your intake of sugar changes your sense of taste. This certainly mirrors my own experience as well as that of my patients. Many years ago, I used to have sugar in my tea. When I first tried it without, the taste was disgusting. But, fast forward a few weeks, I accidentally picked up someone else's sugar tea at work and almost spat it out. One of the major issues is that we're biologically hardwired to crave sugar. One of the world's leading experts in evolutionary biology, Harvard's Professor Daniel Lieberman, says that sugar is a deep, ancient craving that probably evolved to help us survive. Gorging on sweet fruits during the summer enabled us to store fat that we then used during periods of food scarcity in the winter. Simply put, Lieberman has stated, humans evolved to crave sugar, store it, and then use it. For millions of years, our cravings and digestive systems were exquisitely balanced because sugar was rare. Apart from honey, most of the foods our hunter-gatherer ancestors ate were no sweeter than a carrot. We're wired to crave sugar in order to store it as energy in the form of fat. But modern food technology has allowed ultra-sweet flavors to proliferate. A once useful survival adaptation has now become problematic. Because there's so much sugar in our diets, we continually find our blood sugar levels soaring. Studies into the effects of these sudden sugar spikes on the brain have found they trigger intense activation in a region called the nucleus accumbens, an area that's involved with reward, pleasure, addiction, and saliency, how drawn you are to a stimulus that causes these effects, such as a chocolate bar or a milkshake. Remarkably, this is the same area that lights up in people who have addictions to drugs, such as cocaine, heroin, and nicotine. Our consumption of high-sugar foods is having a similar impact on the brain. Some researchers believe we can't say that food is addictive in the same way as cocaine because we need food to live. But I say we do not need sugar to live. For me, it's absolutely clear sugar has genuinely addictive properties. Our unrelenting consumption of sugar, whether it's an obvious component of a bag of sweets or hidden way down the ingredients list in our supermarket whole wheat bread, sets us off on a blood sugar roller coaster. If you start the day with foods that are either high in sugar or are converted in your body to sugar, foods like white bread and breakfast cereal, your blood sugar soars and you go into a buzzy high. 2 or 3 hours later, however, it crashes. Then you're craving sugar again. My patients always tell me, I need to eat every few hours because when I don't, I get shaky and I really need something. That's a symptom. It shows me they're probably riding that sugary roller coaster. If humans really did have an inability to go more than a few hours without food, we'd have died out long ago. The fix isn't to keep feeding the roller coaster. It's to get off it completely. Symptoms that may indicate over-reliance on sugar. Feeling the need to eat every 2 hours. Concentration dropping mid-morning. Experiencing an afternoon slump. Feeling hungry. Irritability between meals. Feeling shaky or dizzy. Experiencing a huge boost in energy or fatigue after your meal. Over-reliance on caffeine and sugar to keep me going. Craving for sweet foods and snacks between meals. Feeling lightheaded if you're late for a meal. Your diabetes risk. If we don't get our sugar consumption managed properly, there's a serious risk we're going to end up damaging our health. There's a strong likelihood we could even end up with type 2 diabetes. The important thing to know about this disease is that by the time you end up with a diagnosis, things will have been going wrong in your body for many years already. It's not something like a chest infection, in that you have it or you don't. The formal diagnosis comes only when you pass a certain arbitrary point along a scale. This, in a nutshell, is how it works. One of the body's key functions is to keep blood sugar within a tightly controlled range. When you consume sugar or foods that are quickly converted to sugar, such as most supermarket bread and bagels, your body pumps out a tiny dose of a hormone called insulin to bring your levels back to normal. The problem is, if we've been abusing this system for a long period of time, our bodies become resistant to this tiny dose of insulin, needing more and more of it to have the same effect. In high amounts, insulin is toxic. Your body is now poisoning itself. When this poisoning gets to a certain level and your blood sugar can no longer be adequately controlled, we call it type 2 diabetes. But that's just the end stage of a long process that's been going on for years. Type 2 diabetes. There are many factors, in addition to excessive sugar consumption, that contribute to the development of insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes. They include too much highly processed food, physical inactivity and low muscle mass, sleep deprivation, persistently high stress levels, disturbed gut bug ecosystem, low levels of vitamin D usually caused by lack of sunshine, environmental toxins. Many patients will have more than one contributory factor, which is why a 360-degree approach to health such as the one outlined in this book, is so important. If a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes has already been made, there are some special dietary considerations that should be followed. Diabetics have a relatively low tolerance of carbohydrates, particularly refined carbohydrates. This is why I advise those affected to reduce their intake of all refined and processed carbohydrates, such as bread, pasta, bagels, and muffins, and even non-refined ones, like white potatoes, that can also spike your blood sugar. In the short term, I also advise them to eat fewer starchy vegetables, such as sweet potatoes, parsnips, and carrots, while I address the underlying causes. I always aim to reintroduce these starchy vegetables at a later date, owing to their beneficial impact on the gut microbiome, though that isn't always possible without a detrimental effect. I have also found that periods of fasting can be very helpful in reducing insulin and sugar levels. Note, if you are a type 2 diabetic and on medication, you must consult a healthcare professional before making significant changes to your diet, such as prolonged fasting. Beyond diabetes. A great many of us, after years of gorging on sugar and junk, have unknowingly become insulin resistant. On top of the 3.5 million Britons who are thought to have passed the point of a full diagnosis, an incredible 1 in 3 adults in Britain are thought to have what's known as pre-diabetes. This means they're already insulin resistant to a certain degree. They're being poisoned, they just don't yet realize it. But sugar's doing more than just giving us type 2 diabetes. As we have just learned, sugar increases our insulin levels, and one of insulin's main roles is to direct fat storage. It tells our bodies to hold on to fat by storing it. So more insulin means we're heavier. Chronically raised insulin levels have been associated with obesity, increased levels of VLDL, a particularly harmful form of cholesterol, raised blood pressure owing to increased retention of salt in water, increased breast cancer risk, raised testosterone levels in women, which is associated with conditions such as polycystic ovaries. But as bad as all this might sound, it's important that we don't swing too far in the other direction. I don't buy the hypothesis that sugar alone is responsible for the obesity epidemic. It is a big contributor, sure, but it isn't the whole story. Obesity and any chronic manifestation of suboptimal health has many contributing factors, and that's why this program is focused on balancing all aspects of health. Good, sustainable health isn't about demonizing any one aspect of our diets, whether it's fat, carbs, or even sugar. Humans have been eating honey for hundreds of thousands of years. The point is, it should be an occasional treat rather than the daily norm. Taking the plunge. Some of my patients prefer to go cold turkey and cut out all sugar for 14 days. This can be an excellent way to retrain your taste buds quickly, but will often lead to withdrawal symptoms such as headaches, irritability, and insomnia, especially between days 3 and 6. However, once past 10 days, patients often report many benefits, including improved sleep, mood, and energy. You might prefer a more gradual reduction in your sugar intake. This is absolutely fine. You should go at a pace that you are comfortable with. Cutting it out of your tea or coffee is a great place to start. That's what I did. No matter where you start from, reducing your sugar intake will benefit your health. Whichever route you choose, you will have to start training yourself to look at ingredient lists. Sugar is lurking where you least expect it, and in many different disguises, such as glucose, dextrose, glucose syrup, cane sugar, glucose fructose syrup, molasses, cane juice, and rice syrup. While you are retraining your taste buds, I would also recommend you avoid natural forms of sugar, such as honey and maple syrup. Try to purge your house of all sugars, both hidden and obvious. We all crave sugar. So, what do you think is going to happen when you come home after a bad day at work, stressed out? If that packet of cookies or chocolate is sitting in the cupboard, do you really think willpower will be enough? Every day, every week, every month? Hell no. You will crack. Increase your chances of success. However you approach cutting down your sugar intake, You might find the following strategies helpful. Plan limited social engagements for the first 2 weeks. These are the hardest times when cutting out or reducing sugar intake. Being around other people and their chocolate and cookies can be a big source.